This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My first guest is Stephen Colbert. It was just over a year ago that he took over CBS's The Late Show after David Letterman retired. Colbert has an election night special coming up, but not on CBS because The Late Show will be preempted by election coverage. So he's doing a special on Showtime called Stephen Colbert's Live Election Night, Democracy's Series Finale. Who's going to clean up this stuff? It'll be on from 11 to midnight. We're going to talk about why he ended the Colbert Report 2 years ago and decided it was time to drop his persona, and what it's been like to create his version of The Late Show and discover who he is on stage out of persona. Colbert's been doing comedy about the election on The Late Show nearly every night. Let's start with an excerpt of last Tuesday's monologue.
And it's been a very good week for Donald Trump. His poll numbers are up. Hillary's email scandal is relevant again. And he just got his second newspaper endorsement. Is it the Journal? Is it the Post? No. It's the Crusader, the political voice of white Christian America. Yes, Donald Trump has been endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan newspaper. We finally answer the question, what's white and white and white all over? And I don't know about you. But when I first heard this, I was like, what took you so long? Was the Klan on the fence? I don't know. Maybe Jill Stein.
Right.
Maybe Jefferson Davis. Not sure who we're going to endorse this time.
Stephen Colbert, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your new show. Not so new, but it's the first time I've spoken to you since you've been doing late night.
Thanks for having me back. I'm really happy to talk to you.
Well, I'm thrilled. So you've got an election night special coming up, a live special, which is going to be on Showtime instead of CBS, I assume, because CBS is going to be doing actual news coverage of the election. So
yes.
Your show is being billed as Democracy's Series Finale. Anything you can tell us? Anything else you can tell us about what it will be like?
It's going to be like my show in that it's going to be the most jokes we can do about the latest thing that has just happened. The reason why we're doing it over at Showtime is because I don't know why this didn't occur to me, but a couple of months ago, we were going over our schedule for the fall, and my showrunner, Chris Licht, said, and of course, obviously, we've got election night off. And I said, what do you mean we've got election night off? We've been doing all these live shows. We did live convention shows. We're doing live debate shows. Why would we be off on election night? And he goes, because Scott Pelley will be broadcasting. And I went, oh, of course. How dumb of me. And I said, is there anything to be done? And so he called Showtime, and they were into it. And so that's why we're going over there. But we want to do the show that we've been doing, which is, you know, we're like trick shooters. How many coins of the news that just happened can you shoot out of the sky before they hit the ground? And we'll have a panel of politicos. We'll have, you know, entertainers. We'll have musical guests. It's going to be the show with more of a purely political bent to it because of the subject of the night. And we'll have live results. You can actually watch to find out what's happening.
And will you be able to say things that you can't say on CBS language-wise?
Oh, and things I can't say on NPR for damn sure. Can you say damn sure on NPR?
I hope so.
Okay. Yes. I'm really looking forward. We might actually just run a clip of all the things that have been bleeped that I've said on CBS so far. And believe me, they're pretty mild. You cannot even use a euphemism for the thing that you're not saying.
How do you feel about
CBS?
That? Is that cramping your style?
I love it.
Why?
There's nothing like, because, I mean, road races are fun, but steeplechases are even more fun to watch. And having to jump over the stupid rules is just more opportunities for jokes.
So I want to play another clip from The Late Show. This is from October 28th. And this was after Megyn Kelly and Newt Gingrich had the big dust-up on her show. Because he accused her of being fascinated with sex and not caring about public policy after she had asked about allegations of Donald Trump's sexual predatory behavior. And she responded by saying that she's fascinated by the protection of women. So, again, this is about him accusing her of not caring about public policy. And here's what you had to say.
But the thing is, Megyn Kelly file isn't talking about fun time bedroom whoopee making. She's talking about assault. Oh, Wait, unless Newt doesn't know the difference, maybe no one gave him the talk. Hold on, let's do this. Newt, sweetheart, you're growing up so fast. In fact, you're 73. Your body's changing. You've probably noticed some strange new hair growing on your earlobes. It's perfectly natural. You're old enough to finally learn about the birds and the bees and the consent. You see, when a man has special feelings for a woman and he wants to give her a special hug, he asks her a special question. You up? But grabbing a lady because you're a TV star is not sex. It's assault. And fun fact, assault is a matter of public policy because it's illegal, even if you use Tic Tacs. I hope that clears things up, buddy. I would explain to you what sex is, but then I'd have to picture you doing it.
Stephen Colbert, that's really, like, hilarious. Can you take us a little bit through the process of coming up with that sketch?
In the morning pitch meeting, someone said, did you hear what Newt did last night? And I said, no, what was it? And they told me what he did. And I went, oh, my gosh, what an interesting emotional moment for him and for her. And you saw Megyn Kelly in the video. You see Megyn Kelly sort of really throw up her armor and go, all right, well, this is how you're going to behave. It turned from what could have been an interview with ease to one where she was deeply armored and shot a barb at him about, I'll let you deal with your, I'll let you go so you can deal with your anger issues. And it became an emotional moment rather than an informational moment. And I really, that was very interesting to me. And we want more than anything else than to talk about everything that just happened as quickly as we can to leave no meat on the chicken for the next day, which is different than the way we used to do our show, because it used to be that I was always skiing in Jon Stewart's wake. And I knew that he was going to pick the chicken, as we would say, or eat every berry on the bush of that day's news. We had a hunter-gatherer relationship. John would do all the gathering, which is every nut, every berry that's growing that day, and we would do the hunting. We would talk about a single subject maybe for a week, or we would think about one idea that we might do 3 or 4 days from now, or maybe 2 weeks from now, as we developed the idea and how my character might put himself in that news story. Now it's how fast can you talk about everything that happened in the news or in popular culture in the last 24 hours. And it's much faster than we used to work. It's, you know, the joke I've made is that we went from go-kart to NASCAR with all the, you know, advertising stickers on the side of our car too.
Do you feel, as just as a person, as opposed to as a performer, do you feel especially invested in this election, and is that affecting how you're dealing with it as a performer?
I mean, this is a very emotional election. I've done this enough to know that it always gets emotional, especially toward the end. But this one has particular emotion because I don't think there's an equivalency of the candidates. I think that you have someone who is, in Hillary Clinton, someone who is been around for a long time, but actually represents, if I were to be pejorative, represents a steeped in what you would think of as the common systemic corruption of Washington, D.C., but that her experience obviates that particular sin to a degree that seems necessary in a complicated world. Donald Trump seems like a monstrous aberration of our political history. We have never flirted with strongman before, not at this level. And so the political stakes seem enormous, and so the emotional investment is unprecedented.
So in addition to trying to be funny and entertain your audience, do you feel like you're also trying to make an argument with your comedy that, look at this election, look at how important it is, here's how I feel about the candidates?
I don't think I've been subtle about how I feel about Donald Trump. So it's less of an argument and more of a look at the flaming carcass shambling toward us. And we should probably not touch that thing. You know, look, it's rabid. Don't touch it. But that's not the same thing as making an argument against him or for Hillary Clinton, because I don't think we've made an argument for Hillary Clinton. I think people's hesitancy about Hillary Clinton is completely reasonable. We just happen to be in extraordinary circumstances. In fact, I can imagine that Trump might be the only person she could beat because she's not a great candidate and she's got a lot of flaws and a lot of baggage that she can't shake off, however historic or even prepared for the job she is in this case.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Colbert, and he's going to be doing a special edition of The Late Show on election night. Since CBS will be running actual news, he's going to be doing a version of his show, Election Night, on Showtime, where he will also be able to use language that he cannot use on his show broadcast on CBS. So, Stephen, what made you realize it was time to end the rapport?
I didn't really want to model the behavior of punditry anymore because I thought it was, A, limiting on a certain level, that I wanted to be able to do more than that character. And I also didn't, I guess the word would be, I didn't respect my model anymore. And I...
Wait, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people always said it was Bill, but it's punditry in general, the sense of certainty, regardless of the facts, that was embodied in the idea of truthiness. That was the thesis statement for the entire show. That how you feel is more important than what the facts are, and that the truth that you feel is correct is more important than anything that the facts could support, which we expressed in a very concise way on the show. We embodied it satirically, though it's not really a new idea. And as you can see, it's been amplified in interesting ways since we went off the air. But I didn't want to play that game anymore. That was a single thesis statement that we tried to remind ourselves of every day. When in doubt, I would just sort of recite those mantras to myself about what is truthiness, and I'm looking out for you, and because I'm looking out for you, I'm also looking over your shoulder because I've got your back, and I have a special relationship with the audience, that is, and it's only us. We're the only ones who get it, and if you agree with me, I love you, and please love you because I agree with you. And all those emotional ideas, I'd have to remind myself every day to stay in character. And I'd remind myself of them right before I went on stage every night because I thought, well, you've come this far. Why blow it now? And toward the end of the show, I started to think that my love of that game was diminishing to the point that I might actually drop the entire China set one day. Because I just couldn't take playing that character anymore.
Like accidentally drop it?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I began to feel like I was stumbling downhill with an armful of bottles and that I couldn't actually keep up the discipline. Because it took discipline to remind myself every day to, you know, be the character. Don't be yourself. And I began to wonder, well, what would it be like to be me? And so I decided a couple years before the show ended that I was going to end the show. About 2 years. I said, okay, this will be the last round of shows that I'll do. And I remember looking at looking at the calendar and saying, what's our last day in 2014? And they go, oh, it's the 18th. It's Thursday the 18th. I said, okay, great. And I circled it on the calendar and I knew, okay, that's the last day I'm doing it. Last time I'm doing this show. And it was not because I didn't like it anymore. I still liked it, but I just thought, like, I'm not sure if I can actually keep this up. Without hurting someone.
Hurting someone?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I don't know. It's a feeling. I thought maybe I would make some big mistake with the character because he would say terrible things. And I got away with some of the terrible things he would say or do because it was all filtered through his mask, but if I didn't maintain the mask, it would just be me being terrible. And he would say hateful things or hurtful things. And I thought, well, if I don't play this tightly, if I don't hit the bell just right all the time, not that it was a perfect performance, but what I mean is if I didn't maintain this discipline, and I felt my discipline slipping, if I didn't maintain that discipline, I would simply slide into being like the thing that I was mocking.
At what point did you know that you would be hosting The Late Show? Like, you'd made the decision to stop The Colbert Report before you knew, right?
It fell out of the sky. It was it was absolutely no part of my plans when I decided to end the Colbert Report. That happened literally years later. It was a complete surprise to me. It hadn't been an ambition of mine. And I'd just been an enormous fan of Dave, and so I had great respect for what he had built. But when they called and said, okay, how about you, I was shocked.
When you started doing The Late Show as opposed to The Colbert Report, and you were able to drop The Colbert Report persona, did you know what your authentic voice was going to be? You know, what your voice is, like the actual Stephen Colbert was going to be? Because you still have to have like a bit of a persona as an entertainer on stage.
I don't think so. I knew that it would be a little bit of a public discovery. You know, what's it's somebody else's joke, but life is like learning to play the violin in public. You don't know what you're doing until you do it. And I knew that there'd be a learning curve that had to happen in public, on air. I would say that what I didn't anticipate was how much I would overcorrect for not doing the character.
What do you mean?
I think, well, because I was not talking about politics. I wasn't doing a monologue on the day's events when we first started. I mean, I would still talk about what was happening, but it wasn't highly focused. It did not have intention, and I wasn't speaking all that honestly because I was attempting to do something different than I had done before. And the overcorrect, I would say, is that not realizing that through the character, I was actually speaking very honestly and you were hearing my voice a lot of the time. You know,
I felt that way as a viewer.
Yeah, there's a confessional aspect to wearing a mask. You know, the same reason why it's easier to confess behind a screen to a priest than face to face. And so by the character was a 10-year confession, perhaps of, you know, indulging ego and appetite through the person of this character. Then you go on stage as yourself and you're responsible for everything you say. And there's a natural inclination to pull your punch because you have to be responsible for what you're saying. You cannot hide behind on the mask. And also that if you talk about politics all the time, well, isn't that what that other guy did? Why would I, or talk about the news all the time? Well, then how am I changing in any way? And it took me, I would say it took me almost half a year to realize that those two aren't mutually exclusive, that you can have a highly opinionated, highly topical show as yourself and not essentially fall back into the basket of the Colbert Report. And now I have no qualms about being sharp and satirical and highly opinionated and saying whatever's on my mind as quickly as I can, and not worrying about that I'm playing the same game. I know I'm not playing the same game, but it took me a little while to realize that the character was not in danger of reemerging.
Yeah, I was really glad when you added more political satire at the top of the show.
Yeah, me too. It's much more enjoyable. And the audience enjoys it. And it's more honest, actually, because it's what I consume all day.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing comedy now, not behind the anchor desk, though sometimes you're doing a monologue behind the anchor desk, but you're often doing it.
Yeah, I sit down there. If it requires graphics and if it requires a sustained argument, I do it behind the desk.
But sometimes you're doing it standing up. And
yeah. So most of the time.
So what have you had to learn in terms of, like, you know, walking out and standing in front of the microphone, figuring out what to do with your hands?
was easy. That part was really fast. But to enjoy taking my time with it, that's the thing. And seeing the smiles on the people in the front row unlocked the door for me and allowed me to really enjoy it. You've got to sincerely enjoy what you're doing or else the audience, I think, can sniff it. And it took me a few months to really enjoy standing there. And as you can see, show first started, we did like 3-minute opening monologues. Now we do 10-minute opening monologues because I don't want it to end. I want to stay there on stage with them.
It seems to me one of the hard parts of doing an opening monologue is what to do when the audience is laughing.
What to do when the audience is laughing?
Yeah. Like,
oh,
do you
gosh.
Say something? Do you repeat the punchline? Do you just keep your hands in your pockets? Do you
hide your erection? Yeah. What do you do? What do I do while the audience is laughing? That is the hardest part of the job. What will I do while the audience is laughing? It's such a challenge, you know. How was the show last night? It was so hard. Why? The audience laughed so much, I didn't know what to do with myself. Oh.
No, but really, you got to
do
something.
What
do you do? You do
levitate.
Have to do something.
Nail your feet to the floor because you'll just fly up under the rafters. What does you do? You lean into it like it's a wind. It's the greatest feeling in the world. What do you do? That's the easiest part of the job. You smile and you're happy that they're happy. That's it. And then you're like, oh, you know what the biggest challenge is?
What?
It's where do you jump back in to get to the next joke?
Right,
how do you ride that energy to the next joke? How then can I use what they've given me to give them a better rhythm, a better joke the next time around? How can I slide down the front face of their wave to give them better energy back? It's like, how can I make this a reciprocal relationship? How can I make this good, this moment feel as good for them as it's feeling for me right now? What can I give back to them? And because comedy is about rhythm, it's like where you jump in on their laughter is really it may be the only decision you're making. And if you're really feeling it, it's not a decision at all. So there's nothing to worry about while the audience is laughing.
So you have to wait for the right amount of decay of laughter before you come back in.
Exactly. And if this wasn't radio, I would graph it for you.
You probably would. Stephen, I absolutely love talking with you. I'm so glad you came back to our show, and I'm so glad you're back on TV.
it is a pleasure talking to you, Terry, because when I found out I'd be talking to you again, I thought, oh, I'm talking to Terry. Maybe the show means something.
I love the show. I'm so glad
you're
doing it. And I look forward to seeing what you're going to do election night. Stephen Colbert hosts CBS's The Late Show. Next Tuesday, when his show is preempted by election news coverage, Colbert will host a special on Showtime called Stephen Colbert's Live Election Night, Democracy's Series Finale. Who's going to clean up this stuff? It will be on from 11 to midnight. Leonard Cohen has just released an album of new songs called You Want It Darker. Cohen, who is now 82, writes frequently about the fragility of life. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I'm traveling light. It's au revoir. My once so bright, my fallen star. I'm running late. They'll close the bar. I used to play one mean guitar. I guess I'm just.
In a certain sense, Leonard Cohen's talents qualify him supremely to be a chronicler of oncoming death. His voice sounds as though it is emerging from a tomb, most often now a ghostly whisper, offering serious contemplation, wry observations, and sly taunts to friends, fans, and whoever may be waiting for him on the other side. The tendency of the melodies to fall into a stately cadence has never seemed more appropriate to the lyrics he's now writing.
I'm leaving the table. I'm out of the game. I don't know the people in your picture frame. If I ever loved you, oh, no, no. It's a crying shame if I ever loved you. If I knew your name.
In a recent profile in The New Yorker, David Remnick quotes Leonard Cohen as saying of his current life, "The big change is the proximity to death." "I've got some work to do," Cohen tells Remnick. "Take care of business. I am ready to die. I hope it's not too uncomfortable." The sentiments would be unbearably sad were they not uttered in the context of such vital creativity. The New Yorker profile is, among other things, a promotional item for this new album, which features some of Cohen's simplest yet most effective lyrics. His mordant sense of humor mixes with religious righteousness on the title song, in which Cohen's vocal slithers through the music like a serpent.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker. We kill the flame. Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. I'm ready, my lord.
I recently re-listened to some of Cohen's earlier work, particularly my favorite album of his, 1988's I'm Your Man. And I was struck by how much his voice has changed slowly, steadily, without my realizing the extent of the change. Yes, the process of aging has further constricted his always limited range and added a sandpapery wear on his vocal cords. Aging has also added something to Cohen's performances here, a quietness that comes across as intimacy, as the musical complement to the confidences he's offering in his words. I love one of these new songs called On the Level for a couple of reasons. The first is the aching couplet, "You smiled at me like I was young, it took my breath away." The second is the arrangement of the song, the way a rhythm and blues chorus of female voices joins Cohen's, giving the song an added touch of reality, of being on the level with the listener.
I knew that it was wrong. I didn't have a doubt. I was dying to get back home, and you were starting out. I said I'd best be moving on. You said we have all day. You smiled at me like I was young. It took my breath away. Your crazy fragrance all around. Your secrets all in view. My loss was saying found. My don't was saying do. Let's keep it on the level. When I walked away from you, back on the devil, turn my back on the angel.
This album, You Want It Darker, is filled with an array of metaphors for death. Cohen sings of leaving the table or being out of the game, a phrase that appears in two songs. He picks up the notion of death as the final journey when he sings, "I'm traveling light, it's au revoir." And on the title song, he speaks directly to God, using the Hebrew word for here I am, Hanani, Hanani, I'm ready, my Lord. Among recent albums about facing down final moments, this album finds its only equal with the last recordings of Johnny Cash, who made tremendous music with a voice that was almost escaping his body. What Leonard Cohen is doing here is less a summing up than a living will, complete with gifts for how to negotiate a life for maximum passion.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Leonard Cohen's new album, You Want It Darker. My next guest, Donald Glover, created, co-writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta, which is a hybrid of comedy and drama set on the fringes of Atlanta's hip-hop scene. The first season's finale was Tuesday. Glover plays Earn, short for Ernest, a Princeton dropout who's broke. When we first meet him, he has an alienating job working at an airport kiosk trying to sign people up for a credit card. He comes up with an idea that he hopes will be a way out, managing the music career of his cousin Alfred, an underground rapper who performs under the name Paperboy but makes his living selling drugs. Earn is the perpetual outsider, whether it's in the hip-hop world or his own family. He's on the outs with his parents because he's asked them for money too many times, and his on-and-off-again girlfriend, who's the mother of his young daughter, is often fed up with him, although she usually lets him live at her place since he doesn't have one of his own. Although Donald Glover's character doesn't rap, Glover does. He records under the name Childish Gambino. He's received 2 Grammy nominations. He's also a stand-up comic, wrote for 30 Rock, and played Troy on the comedy series Community. Let's start with a scene from the first episode of Atlanta, when Earn first tries to convince his cousin to let him be his manager. Earn is at his cousin's house. His cousin's friend and roommate Darius is there, too. The cousin, Paperboy, is played by Brian Tyree Henry. Darius is played by Lakeith Stanfield.
So, zoo tycoons.
You want in on Paperboy?
What? No?
Please, man. People ain't just nice, Earn. When was the last time you were nice to a girl you weren't trying to smash?
This morning?
You talking about your daughter, man. That's gross.
No, it would be gross if I was trying to smash. I don't want a handout. I want to manage you.
Manage? You know where the word manage come from?
Manus, Latin for hand.
Probably, but I'm going to say no for the purpose of my argument. Manage come from the word man, and that ain't really your lane.
My lane?
Yeah, man, I need Malcolm. You too, Martin. You know what they did to him? They killed him.
Didn't they kill Malcolm, too?
Well, no, they say that. But ain't nobody seen the body since the funeral.
That's how funerals work. Alfred, you already Malcolm, okay? You have that already. What you really need is a silent wild card. Somebody who's about the money, the opportunity, who can play both sides if needed.
Oh, like Don Lemon.
Fair point. Let me rephrase what I'm trying to say.
Oh, wait. It's 4:30.
Oh, damn, man, we late.
Donald Glover, welcome to Fresh Air. The series starts with the main characters in a car outside a club. 2 people walk by, smash the side view mirror, and Paperboy gets out of the car with his gun. Your character follows him. A shot goes off. It fades to black. We don't know who fired the shot or who got hurt. Why did you want to start it that way?
It didn't seem boring. I felt like it was like an honest altercation, and it was the beginning of that universe. I think that just like that set of like those 3 kind of like are tied together.
After the shooting, Earn, your character, and Paperboy are in the police station waiting to be booked. And everyone there is acting kind of like it's a bad day at the DMV, and they have to deal with this awful bureaucracy, and they've been here before, and they know the way the game is played, and they don't want to be there, but it's something you have to endure. And the people who work there seem to have the same attitude. And it's portrayed as just being like a routine part of life. Not so much for your character, who seems newer to it.
He's never done it.
Yeah. Where does that scene come from? The kind of attitude of like, yeah, that's what happens.
I think it is kind of humdrum when you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
Jail is just time out for adults. And I think the people in it, like, it's not like harrowing. Like when you see, like, we tried really hard to make the jail look as boring as it actually is. Like even usually when you see a jail, it's like people behind bars and like their like hands are sticking out and they're like yelling and people are like quiet down in there and like it's like active, but it's not. It is humdrum. It is like the DMV, but the actual thing of like jail is just people being like, okay, like let's put you in this system so it's easier to bring you back in this system. And I think, like, probably the people working there are kind of like, yeah, I don't like this place either. Like, but, you know, how else are we going to eat?
And do you know this from, like, going there for research or having been there waiting to be booked for something or having friends tell you about it?
2 of the writers spent the night in jail, and that was, like, the feeling they said. It was, like, you know, the way they're describing it. Which is the reality for most people. It's like, you know, you get sent in there sometimes on something that's super bogus, and then they have you sit down, and then they tell you you can't sleep, even though it's like even my character says that. It's like, but everybody always has slept. Like, how can you make us not sleep in here? Especially when it's taking hours upon hours for you to do what we need you to do to just move on. You know, it's a very, like, weird power dynamic. But yeah, it came from like a personal experience of 2 of the writers, Steven, my brother.
Oh yeah, your brother. Your brother actually does the what should I call it, the title rap for the series.
The track
called Paperboy. That's your brother doing it, right?
Yeah, that's my brother. Yeah, rapping.
Did you write it or did he write it?
I just wrote like the hook and like had some like lines, but like one thing that we were trying to do was like, you know, we wanted it to be something that felt real. You know, so we tried to make this super simple. Like, what would be something that would be just fun and not try and make it like, oh, the best song ever. So like, oh, just like kind of a hood anthem. So we were like, you know, something that feels like it wrote itself, which is, you know, Paperboy, all about that Paperboy. Like, you know, play with the pun of it, or, you know, getting paper and Paperboy. It just felt very like easy, and you weren't overthinking it. And then, you know, when we were in the studio, he was like, yeah, the rest kind of wrote itself. Like, you know, it's easy.
So let's hear the track Paperboy, which ends one of the episodes of Atlanta. And this is performed by Stephen Glover, who raps under the name Stephen G. Glover. Mm-hmm. Did I get that right?
Steve G. Glover,
right, okay. Yeah. Great, so here it is.
Paperboy, always about that paperboy. If you ain't on your grind, then you flexing, you's a hater boy. Paperboy, always getting paperboy. If you ain't making money, then you ain't a money maker boy. Paperclip, yeah, I need a paperclip. I'm stacking up this paper, man, and I can make that paper flip, that paper flip.
So that's Paperboy, which is the song that is the kind of theme song for the character Paperboy on the series Atlanta, which was created and stars my guest Donald Glover. Where did you grow up in Atlanta?
I grew up in a suburb called Stone Mountain.
And tell us about the neighborhood.
It was, I think when we first moved there, it was a pretty, like, standard suburb. There weren't a lot of black people there when we moved in, but I guess within the first 3 or 4 years, like, white flight happened. And yeah, it became predominantly black by the time I was in high school.
Your parents were Jehovah's Witnesses, or are Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how did that affect? I think your parents, from what I know, didn't want you to watch TV, or at least not a lot of TV. But you seem so absorbed in all kinds of pop culture. It seems like it's really important to you. So was it frustrating for you as a kid to not be able to watch what you wanted to watch, or maybe listen to what you wanted to listen to?
Sometimes. Sometimes it was a little frustrating just because you wanted to be part of the group. Anyway, I definitely remember, you know, going to school and people talking about In Living Color and me being like, man, like, I really wish I could watch that. Like, I was like, it sounds really good, like, references. Like, and I would piece, it actually was kind of helpful, because you would kind of piece together jokes that you would hear, and then, like, I'd come up with my own through what I heard. It forced me to be a little bit more imaginative, like, what things could be as opposed to what things were.
That's funny, because it means it helped you become a creator of the kind of material you weren't allowed to watch.
Right, I know. Yeah. They were like, Bart Simpson's a bad influence, like, The Simpsons were no go, and, like, I think that was, like, that album was, like, one of the first albums, like, I listened to.
Oh, really, the album of songs from The Simpsons?
Yeah, like, it had, like, the Bartman on it, and I think Lisa Simpson sings, like, God Bless a Child That Has His Own. And I remember being like, oh, this is all cool. But it's all through, like, The Simpsons. Like, it was funny.
I'm not sure if that's the one or not that also has the musical based on Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, yeah, I had that album, too. I think the first one was, like, a legit kind of album. It had the Bartman and, like, a couple of the things. And then there was an album that came out later that had, like, all the songs, like, the Mr. Burns, like, buying, like, clothes made out of animals, and that the Streetcar Named Desire, like, and, yeah, that one had, like, tons of tracks on it. But the first one, which was just, like, kind of, like, I think people realizing what a huge phenomenon the Simpsons was, I was, like, obsessed with it.
Because you're a comic, a writer, a rapper, an actor, you get to express what you want to say in different forms, in different mediums. So I want to play an excerpt of a comedy special that you did in 2010 on Comedy Central. And this is an excerpt in which you're talking about being a black nerd. And it starts off with you talking about President Obama.
The best part about Obama is that he's a black nerd. I love that jump, because I'm a black nerd, and that was illegal until, like, 2003. It's awesome. It's so awesome. It's like there's black nerds everywhere, you know, like it's awesome. It's so great. And I love it. Like, but it was just hard for us growing up. Like, you know, I remember I was like the only black kid at my school for a while. Like I was the only, I remember I went to a white school and white kids were excited. They were super excited. They were like, oh, we got a black kid. This is awesome. We got a black kid. They were like, oh, hey, Donald, what kind of rap music you into and what kind of sneakers you like? And I was like, oh, I don't really like rap music. I really enjoy the soulful stylings of the Cranberries. We can talk about that. And they were like, nah, man, you like sneakers and you like rap music and you go, tell us which one you like. I was like, oh, you're hurting me, Steven, you know?
That's my guest, Donald Glover. So, okay, so my impression, knowing you only through your work and not as a person, you know, outside of your work, my impression would be that you felt you had black friends and white friends telling you who you were supposed to be, and you weren't fitting into anybody's projections. You were going your own way.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty accurate. I think it's just, you know, it's a weird thing. And I think people always ask about what I do. And a lot of people ask, like, you know, which one's your favorite? Or, like, which one do you relate to the most? And it's hard for me to, I get asked that all the time. And I'm always like, I don't see them as separate things. I'm just going to, like, play them out, you know, with people and be who I am at that time and not ask questions about it.
So after performing arts school, you went to NYU. You studied dramatic writing there. So what were you thinking your future was going to be at that time?
I think I had aspirations of, like, oh, maybe I'll write for, like, Mad TV or, like, SNL. And I think that was, like, kind of it. Like, I think, you know, I went into dramatic writing because, like, I think I got the most money, like, for a scholarship that way, even though I kind of knew, writing plays wasn't going to be the move just because, I mean, like, unless I wanted to be, like, you know, the special snowflake black writer who, like, writes these, like, very specific, like, plays and, like, lives in, like, Manhattan. Not to say, like, it's about money, but I was just, like, I just didn't see myself doing that, but it definitely, like, allowed me to, like, experience New York.
Well, you did do sketch comedy and improv in college and maybe after as well. And one of the groups you were in was the Upright Citizens Brigade, which is, I think, what landed you your first TV job writing for 30 Rock, because Amy Poehler was one of the co-founders of Upright Citizens Brigade, and of course she's very close with Tina Fey, and Tina Fey is a creator of 30 Rock. So that's how you got.
Yeah, I was part of a scholarship program at UCB. You like intern there, like you clean toilets, and they pay you in classes.
So Tina Fey has said that when she brought you on to 30 Rock, that you were the only African-American writer at the show at the time, but that the real diversity you brought was that you were their only, quote, cool young person who could tell them what the kids were listening to these days. Because you came from a large family in Georgia, you were also helpful in writing for the character Kenneth the Page, because the character's from Georgia. So do you remember being used that way, as, like, the cool young person who could tell them what kids were listening to these days?
Yeah, I remember once I pitched a joke about, like, Tracy wearing a T-shirt with a black Bart Simpson on it, or like some joke about that. And I remember Robert, who was, like, the head writer, he was like, "That's funny." And it was like dot dot dot. Like, he's like, "Is that a real thing?" And then, like, I got it. Like, started explaining. I'm like, "Well, yeah. Like, you know, you go to, like, in Atlanta anyway." I was like, "Yeah, you go to the mall, like South Cab Mall." And they have, like, you know, black versions of characters, like, drawn on the T-shirts. And, like, they were cool. And, like, it was weird because I was, like, one of the first times I was, like, oh, this is completely different world from, I know something that, like, these people didn't know existed. It was interesting to find out.
So after, I don't know how long, you decided to leave 30 Rock because you decided you wanted to perform. That must have been a really hard decision to make, because, you know, writing for 30 Rock is it's a really great job, and you were in your 20s, probably in your early 20s. I think you were 21 when you were hired, and you were still living in an NYU dorm working as an RA. So did you think, like, this might be really stupid, but I'm going to quit anyways? You know what I mean? It's really risky to have such a great job and decide that you want to pursue something different.
It's only risky if you were happy there.
You weren't?
You know? No, I mean, like, I had a great time, like, and I learned a ton, and I really loved all the people there, and, like, I don't know, I don't think I've, you know, they're some of the funniest people and the smartest people I work with, but I just knew I didn't want to stay there. I never saw it as risky, just because I was like, oh, like, if I know the answer as far as, like, oh, do I want to stay here, like, no, then why stay? Like, I don't know. Like, it was probably, it was just like an honest decision. Like, I didn't second guess it, because, like, I just knew I wasn't going to do what was expected of me there, which was, like, I guess become, you know, go move higher and higher in the ranks and become, like, a showrunner or something. I'm not sure what would have happened, but I knew it just wasn't for me.
Well, Donald Glover, thank you so much. I look forward to season 2 of Atlanta whenever that comes back.
Thank you. It's nice to finally audio meet you.
Donald Glover created, writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta. The show has already been renewed for a second season. Glover's upcoming films include Spider-Man Homecoming and the Han Solo Star Wars movie, where Glover will play a young Lando Calrissian. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer this week is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.